All right, well, let's talk about something that would be basically the end of the biblical view of truth, and that's relativism, roots and refutations. I want to talk about the Corduan and the Moreland material. Really, we've already been through the laws of logic, so let's go down to the challenge of relativism. There are different types of relativism. You can have moral relativism or epistemic relativism. Those are two broad categories. Epistemic relativism says that truth and rationality are completely relative to the individual or possibly to the group of language users. Moral relativism says that morality is relative to the individual or to the language users. Someone could be a moral relativist and not a full-fledged epistemic relativist. That is, they could say that the laws of science are objective and real and knowable, but morality is completely up for grabs. That's contingent and relative. Okay? But either way, this is bad news for the biblical concept of truth and revelation. Because, as I've mentioned, the biblical view is correspondence, factuality, and God has revealed moral truth, summarized in the Ten Commandments and expanded upon in the teachings of Jesus and Paul and so on. So we've got to deal with relativism if we're going to have any chance of defending the biblical worldview. So let me talk a little bit about the challenge of relativism. What relativism tries to do is really deny objective truth claims and deny that the law of non-contradiction... Interestingly, the law of non-contradiction can be called the law of contradiction. It's not because it contradicts itself. It's because it's two ways of saying the same thing, basically. That is, contradictory statements cannot both be true, and for truth to be truth, it has to be non-contradictory. You can just say the same thing in two ways. So you could say Christianity is true. Another person can say Christianity is false, and they don't oppose each other. So if you're thinking about objective truth claims, you would have to deny the law of non-contradiction if they're both true. Or sex outside of marriage is all right for you, but it's not all right for me. Now, if you're talking about any objective moral claim, to say it's all right for one person and not for another, you'd have to deny the law of non-contradiction, which is deeply troublesome and problematic. But what a lot of people do is they say, no, I'm not really denying that per se. I'm just saying that it's my way, you see, or it's my style, or it's my approach, or it's my orientation. And there is no objective truth to it, period. I think that's the more common claim. Not claiming that objective truths contradict each other so much as there are no objective truths to morality or religion. They're subjective, relative, contingent, right, and so on. So they may not be necessarily denying the law of non-contradiction. They may be. People can be irrational in all sorts of creative ways. So it makes truth relative to individuals or cultures. Let's talk a little bit about conceptual relativism and moral relativism. Conceptual relativism claims that concepts mean what you think they mean. So there's no connection really to your thought or your language to any external reality. Now, there may be an external reality out there, but you just can't know it through concepts or propositions. A proposition relates concepts in a declarative form. Okay? Now, how do you deal with a conceptual relativist? You try to show them that they contradict themselves. So when someone says something like, language cannot communicate truth about reality, you say, should I believe that? Are you sure about that? So you're using language to communicate something about reality, namely that language cannot communicate truth about reality. Jim Sawyer once had a student say in one of his open meetings, language cannot communicate truth about reality. And Sawyer said, what? What? So the guy yelled it. And Sawyer said, what? What? And the guy yelled it again and then got frustrated and walked out. It didn't work. He didn't get the point. But do you see the point? You have to presuppose what you deny. You're making an affirmative claim about reality through language. That is, language does not relate or communicate truth about reality. There's a kind of tacit or implicit assertion in a lot of human language. assertion about the facts, even if people deny it. Now, language does all kinds of other things. You ask questions, you give commands, you give emotive utterances, but there is an irreducible assertive core to language. I don't care what language it is. And that connects very clearly to the correspondence view of truth. So with conceptual relativism, I think you try to show people that they refute themselves. And if they try to communicate anything where you have to share thoughts between minds, they'd have to fail. Because I create my own reality, you create your own reality. Where do these realities meet if they're self-created by different people? Where's the common stock? Where's the commonality of concepts and of logic and so on that makes communication possible? See, this just does not work. Now, moral relativism may not buy into conceptual relativism. As I said, only moral concepts are relative. Now, there's a type of relativism called normative relativism that says that what's right is defined by culture, but that there is a normativity to it. So in one culture, one practice, let's say polygamy is correct, in another culture it isn't. But if you're in that polygamous culture, then polygamy is right. If you're in the non-polygamous culture, then polygamy is wrong. Now, the rightness and wrongness is not rooted in anything above culture. Somehow the culture conveys normativity. How that works is pure magic. But somehow it does. And we'll critique this. But there's another kind of relativism that's more the problem in the West, and that is individualist relativism, which is basically, hang culture. It's so diverse and pluralistic anyway, which culture do I belong to? It's me. I determine what's right and wrong by my taste, by my subjective orientation, by what I prefer, what I desire, sort of the preferential view of truth. What I prefer to be true is true. What I want to be true is true. What I'm comfortable with is true. And it's amazing to me how many people will say, I'm comfortable with that, to mean, I think it's true. Think about that for a minute. People say it all the time, I'm comfortable with that. I want to say, in a sense, so what? I mean, I can be, as a fallen being, I can be comfortable with lies and very uncomfortable with the truth. So what does comfort necessarily have to do with truth or falsity or rationality? Anyway, I just give you all these tools to be obnoxious in conversations. So, individualist relativism. So what are some roots of relativism? One, none of them are sufficient to justify the position, obviously. The information explosion makes objective, absolute, universal truth impossible. So much data, so much information, who can sort it all out? Well, again, as I mentioned earlier, there are a finite number of worldviews. And there are a finite number of arguments for worldviews. It's not infinitely difficult to think in terms of worldviews logically. Moreover, if you have access to information, why not try to use it carefully and critically? Simply because you have a lot of information in no way logically means that there's no way to sort it out. And that's just a non sequitur. There's so much information, it can't be sorted out. Well, if you have some clear principles of logic and some concern to apply logic and good reasoning, it's possible. If you avoid garbage, which is 90% of American media, and focus on what might convey truth, then you've already narrowed it down quite a bit. So this one doesn't work. Secondly, and this is very important to work on this, the claim to objective, absolute, universal truth or knowledge, and knowledge is justified true belief, leads to totalitarianism and intolerance. Well, for one thing, that's a claim that's absolute, objective, and universal in itself. If you believe in that kind of thing, you will be like this. So it's self-refuting. But it's also false in another way, because simply because you claim that there is an objective, absolute truth doesn't mean you will want to enforce it on everyone. If you're a Christian, you shouldn't, because biblically, the message is spread through persuasion and prayer and godly living, not through propaganda, not through coercion, and not through enforced baptisms. It's not biblical. If anyone's ever done that, they've gone against the teachings of Jesus and the apostles. Islam is another matter, a very different matter. But simply having a meta-narrative or a worldview that holds to objective, absolute, universal truth does not ipso facto make you totalitarian or intolerant. Moreover, biblically, you can be intolerant of someone's worldview or big chunks of it and still tolerate the person. Meaning, you don't merely tolerate them, you love them. You don't have to convert them. That's between them and God. You try to be a witness to truth. You pray for them. But if they don't accept, that's between God and the person. There's no coercion, no threats in the Christian propagation of Christianity. So this simply does not hold water. Now, have Christians in the name of Christ dominated other cultures? Yes. Colonialism, imperialism, and so on. Although imperialism and colonialism is much more of a mixed story than what you hear in the popular press. That's a big issue. I'm not going to get into that. But have Christians abused the concepts of truth? Certainly. But the question is whether or not they were true to the truth itself. And I would say, show me any passage in the New Testament that implies or entails the coercion of other people's beliefs or behaviors. I don't think you can find anything. And it doesn't work to appeal to the destruction of the Canaanites. That was a very special case under special, unrepeatable conditions. Another point is the sincerity of religious believers means they cannot be wrong. Now, Michelle, who's in class here today, was telling me she teaches at Denver Street School. She was saying she presented this idea recently to the students. And you said, basically, now, isn't if someone's convinced of their belief and they're sincere and they're a good person, that means their belief is right. And all your students said yes, right? Okay, and Michelle had something to say about that. And she did something, I think it was quite ingenious, that she tricked them. She gave them a statement from Osama bin Laden's manual of how to prepare for jihad. It's on the internet. It's been released. So, and then they read that, and then you told them what it was. And what did they respond then? They changed their mind. All right. I hope so. You see, you have to be creative. And that's a very creative way to do it. But if you press people a little bit on this, this just does not hold up. See, some people are relativists and they're just an inch thick relativist. Some people are soul deep relativists, and you hope those people don't get a lot of power and aspire to high office. But some people are inch deep relativists, and if you press them and push them, they can see this doesn't hold up very well. There's a comment? Yeah. Well, you hope that that works, but sadly, back in 97 when that occurred, I was tracking the press on this, and I think I did 9 or 10 interviews with newspapers and radio stations on this. And what I was hearing from a lot of people was, well, that's how religion is. They make their choices. They were martyrs. That really ticked me off. I mean, that ticked me off so much I had to write an editorial in the Rocky Mountain News. They published it. I said, no, martyr is where you give your life for your faith, where someone kills you. It's a heavy philosophical concept. Suicide is where you take your own life. This was dealt with very early on in the history of the church. Augustine wrote on it, others wrote on it, and so on. But I found a lot of people saying, well, you know, that's religion. People do anything in religion, and if it's their religion, it's okay for them. Some people even refuse to condemn Heaven's Gate as irrational because it was religion. And religion is purely personal, private, and subjective. One of the things I said in that editorial was that I think the spiritual immune system of America is broken down when we can't condemn this is the apotheosis of irrationality. I didn't use apotheosis, but you get the point, if you know what the word means. So, I think we can use counterexamples with people, but just the very idea that sincerity means that people are right is a wrong-headed idea. Now, when people are sincere in their beliefs, you need to respect their beliefs, no question. But it doesn't mean you necessarily hold their beliefs to be true or rational. It's a very big difference. See, what worries me, a lot of things worry me, but one of the things that worries me is that we so identify people with their beliefs that if we disagree with their belief, it's a hate crime. You're finding this on college campuses all over the country and in the popular media. If you disagree with someone, especially about their religion, it's akin to racism, hating them because of their skin color. And they're completely different categories. I mean, the whole American proposition, in many ways, is encapsulated in the First Amendment. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, which means an open form of debate. That we can disagree about the things that matter most agreeably in civil society. That's part of the American proposition. But you need a disciplined life of intellectual virtue to pull that off. And we don't have that, largely, in our culture. We have people shouting at each other. We have people accusing each other of various things. Using image, using fake documents, and so on. And that's just the way it works. There's a comment here I squelched. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I never said belief has no power. The belief, sincerity has no power to create truth. The 19 hijackers thought that immediately upon their death, they would be in the presence of exactly 72 virgins in paradise. It's in the Hadith. Guess what? Belief has no power to create truth. It has power to forge cultures. It has power to send people on suicide missions. It has power for people to lay down their lives to serve other people in other countries and bring them medications and bring them the gospel. It's tremendous power. Sure. Sure. But it has no power to create truth. It has social, intellectual power, no question. But the issue is truth and rationality. So if someone holds belief sincerely, they will orient their life around it. And you have to be respectful of that person and that life. But you want to, in the name of Christ, challenge the belief if it goes against a biblical worldview. And that's a difficult situation. It requires a lot of love, prayer, sensitivity, and so on. Does that help? Okay. All right, the sincerity objection doesn't work. Now, some people claim that you can use Buddhist logic or Eastern logic and allow for contradictions to be true. Only Western logic disallows this. As an example, let me cite a scholar of Buddhism, Paul Griffiths, who knows Buddhism better than most Buddhists, who knows the languages that Buddhist scriptures are written in, Pali and Sanskrit and so on. And he says when he studies the texts of Buddhism and the arguments between the different schools of Buddhists, that they use logic. Either or logic, if you want to just put it that way. When Hindus debate Buddhists, they use logic. When Madhva is critiquing Sankara, he says, Sankara, you're illogical. Sankara says, no, Madhva. Well, actually, it didn't work because Madhva came afterwards. But the debates within Hinduism use logic. The debates within Buddhism use logic. When you attempt to transcend logic, you've transcended argument. And religious traditions argue within themselves, and they argue with religious traditions outside of themselves. This happens all the time. Now, you may have noticed that my response to this is a little different than Cordovan's. So, see what you think, which one you think is right. Cordovan says that even Buddhist logic sort of has a realm where non-contradiction obtains and a realm where it doesn't. Well, when they're really trying to give any argument at all, they have to use the law of non-contradiction. And when you deny it in some kind of ineffable mystical experience, that is the end of all argument. I mean, Ravi Zacharias has a great story where he was talking to a professor, and the professor was challenging his view that truth is either or. If you have A, non-A cannot be true, if you've clearly defined your terms. And the professor took him out to lunch and said, no, you have this Eastern form of logic, and then you have a Western form of logic. And he filled up several napkins trying to describe the Eastern both-and logic and the Western either-or logic. And so Ravi Zacharias says, so you have either the Eastern both-and logic or the Western either-or logic. And the guy looked down at the napkins and the scribblings, and he says, the either-or does tend to emerge, doesn't it? Yeah, it's there. Having individual rights mean I can determine my own truth. the basic lack of distinction between the right to your opinion and the right to be right. Yes, in societies that allow individual freedoms, you can believe most anything you want if it's within the bounds of the law, if it doesn't lead to criminal behavior. That by no means indicates that your belief is correct or rational, right? I mean, you can belong to the first church of the transgalactic taco shell. You have a right to do that. It doesn't mean there's any rational warrant to your belief or that your belief is true. They're two separate issues. That's a real simple one. Or, this is one of my favorites, to be humble. And you hear a lot of pomo Christians saying this, from absolute to authentic. To be humble, you can't talk about absolute truth. You have to be open, negotiable. Everything's up for grabs. Basically relativistic. Otherwise, you're a dogmatic person. That is, tolerance, which is a virtue, requires relativism as a support. Now, you tell me, what's wrong with that? You agree with it? Well, it's intolerant of people who think they can communicate absolute truth. And people... Yeah, right, many liberal colleges. You know, be tolerant of everything except the people who think they can communicate absolute truth, and you have to be intolerant of them. But there's another problem with this, too. There are many problems with it. What's another one? Sure, from a biblical viewpoint, any truth you know is a gift of God's grace. So to deny that you know it and deny it to others is a deep mistake. But let's say within a non-Christian framework, tolerance is a virtue. Tolerance requires relativism, so we must be tolerant. Sure. It's merely a social construct. In many cultures, it is not a virtue. It is not a virtue in Iran. All right? It was not a virtue in Afghanistan under the Taliban. Right? It was not a virtue in Hitler's Germany. It's not a virtue in North Korea. So where do we get this tolerance is a virtue concept out of relativism? It doesn't belong there. Basically, what's happening here is that relativists are sponging off of the Christian tradition without admitting it. Because the notion, the classical liberal, I don't mean modern liberal, don't think modern Democrats, the classical liberal notion of tolerance, I'm thinking John Stuart Mill, the founders of the country, was that we can disagree about the things that matter most in a civil fashion if we think rationally and are willing to put up with people that we disagree with. That's tolerance in the classic American sense. It is not relativism. It's an epistemic and moral virtue. It is not relativism. But the modern or the postmodern relativists sponge off of that and as their foundation use relativism, which is no foundation for anything in terms of what determinative virtues are. The question is, why be tolerant? See? They say, well, that's just the way it is. Well, it's not the way it is anywhere, everywhere. And what if I choose to be intolerant? That's part of my lifestyle. And that works for me. And it's very, very meaningful to me. So this one radically fails as well. Okay? Yes. Oh, sure. Sure, I mean, if you have any concept of truth at all, you have to be humble before truth. That is, if I'm wrong, I want to be shown wrong. And if you're wrong, would you want to be showed wrong? That's a humility before truth. It's like, if you can convince me. That is an argument. I mean, go back to Socrates. He had a lot of good things to say. The point of an argument is not for one person to win or the other person to win. It's for truth to win through rationality. That's the point of an argument. I think as Christians, we can adopt that. I mean, Jesus interacted with people through dialogue, through argument. Now, he was the embodiment of truth. We're not. But we still have access to it, and we can still use our minds to communicate it. You could just say to somebody, look, if you're wrong, wouldn't you want to know it? I would. Now, if right and wrong just means your opinion, then you can never be wrong, and you're always right. Pretty arrogant, I'd say. I am always right. because I'm an expert on what I believe, and what I believe is true for me. Next question. Try to learn anything with that kind of a posture. All right, let me just talk a little bit about Moreland, skip to the section on Moreland on his argument against relativism. Now, you can say by relativism, you can mean simply a descriptive claim that different cultures have different moral perspectives. That is true in a limited sense. However, when you get to some pretty basic things about social and sexual mores, there's more agreement than you might think. C.S. Lewis deals with this in The Abolition of Man. And in the appendix to that book, he goes through ancient and modern civilization, quoting Egyptian religion, Christianity, the Bible, Hinduism, Confucius, Western philosophers, and he shows there's a basic agreement on what he calls the Tao, or the basic moral law. So even descriptively, there's not as much disagreement as some people claim. But there is disagreement. But even if there were massive disagreement, that would not entail relativism is true. It would simply mean there's massive disagreement about human values. What follows from that? Nothing. What follows from that is there's massive disagreement about human values. The question is whether people have properly identified the values. You can have massive disagreement on cosmology. That doesn't mean everyone's right. There are probably still some pre-modern people, some Aboriginal people, who believe the Earth rotates around the sun. They happen to be wrong. All right? They may think that, what? Okay, yeah, I switched it around. They may be geocentric when they should be heliocentric. Okay? So, I don't think I said it wrong. I have to check the tape. Anyway. I hate it when you think one thing and say another. I mean, language, where's our resident critiquer of everything I say about language? Yeah, language is fallible when you're me, that's for sure. So if you can get things wrong cosmologically, why can't you get things wrong morally? So descriptive relativism, well, that's interesting for anthropologists, but what about the deeper claim? Now, what about this idea that you should follow what your culture claims is true? All right? What's normative is what your culture claims is true. Well, which culture? If you're an Australian Aborigine, it's quite easy. If you're an American, it's not easy at all. This is an indeterminacy problem. All right, maybe you're an American, you have some religious affiliation, you might be going to college. Which culture becomes determinative? Because they may disagree. Let's say you come from a conservative evangelical church and you get involved in a real rowdy sorority fraternity. You have some pretty different cultural values between your church and your sorority or fraternity. Which one becomes normative? What is your binding culture? It becomes very difficult to say. Because you may belong to more than one culture. I mean, what is it that determines the morally relevant culture? Moreover, you've got reformers that come along who critique the entire culture. Think of Martin Luther King. I mean, he appealed to many of the principles in our founding documents, particularly the Declaration of Independence, and said we needed to live true to those founding principles. But he went against most of the American tradition about race relationships. Or think of Gandhi, or think of others. Think of the suffragettes that argued for the right of women to vote. They've only had the vote since 1920 in America. Think about it. They were going against the cultural tide. Now, how do you go against the cultural tide if you're a relativist? You can't. What moral reformers do is they appeal to essences. They appeal to foundations. The suffragists said things like, women are equal to men with respect to moral and political discernment. Or they said, women are superior to men in moral and political discernment. They were making a claim about essences. They were making a claim that the culture was largely wrong. And King did the same thing. Look, we have to live true to our founding principles, even if we have never done so previously. And these founding principles are not constructs of the founding fathers. They're based on the rights that God Almighty gives us. And he believed that. He was, after all, a minister and the son of a minister. He was raised in the black church. Now, if relativism is true, this kind of normative relativism, then any reformer is in principle a deviant and should be squashed. Because the culture, assuming you can even determine what that is, defines what's right and wrong. So if King is in the minority, or Gandhi's in the minority, or the suffragettes are in the minority, they're wrong, period. Now that argument is called a reductio ad absurdum. You're reducing the argument to absurdity, because I think we know, at least at this point, that the suffragettes, that Gandhi, that Martin Luther King, were not wrong. They were arguing for what was right, even though it was unpopular, even though they had to stand against the tide. Now, when they stood against the tide, they could not enlist the tide to their services. They had to talk about transcendent moral principles. And interestingly, Gandhi did so on the basis largely of Christianity, not Hinduism, even though he never converted to Christianity. His idea of calling the untouchables God's children did not come from Hinduism. It came from Christianity. Very interesting. Moreover, some acts are clearly wrong, whatever society you're in. And we do have a knowledge, a basic knowledge, of some acts as clearly wrong. So when you're dealing with relativists, you can appeal to what's called a counterexample. A counterexample is an example that contradicts what your interlocutor thinks. So, well, right and wrong is a matter of subjective opinion, cultural construct. One person's terrorist, another person's freedom fighter. Well, you might want to introduce what happened in Russia 10 days ago. Really? So if people are that dedicated to the cause, it's right to capture a school and torment people for, was it 52 hours, something like that? Give them no food, no water, and then kill most of them. So that's right for them. And so for their people, they're freedom fighters. But maybe to someone else, they're a terrorist. But there's really no fact of the matter. So you try to pursue counterexamples. And what counterexamples work depends on the individual you're dealing with. So you have to be creative in the counterexamples that you use. You try to get to know the person. You find out what they value most highly. And then you think of a counterexample that cuts against that value. I did this with a student that took one of my classes almost 25 years ago, who said he was a nihilist. I said, okay, Matt, what if I told you that some thugs broke into your house, your parents' house last night, and for no reason whatsoever except to have fun, killed your parents? And I could tell by his expression he was shocked. He was stunned just by the very thought experiment. And then he kind of regrouped and got his nihilist clothes back on. And he said, oh, I couldn't really condemn it as wrong. And I said, come on, Matt, your initial response of revulsion and being repulsed by the very thought was what you know to be true. So counterexamples can be very useful. Now, given this theory also of normative relativism, one society could never blame another society for being morally wrong if societies and cultures determine what's right and wrong, in principle, right? You already have the indeterminacy problem. Now, with some cultures, you may not because they're more unified. There are basic cultural take-it-for-granted in some situations. But when nations go to war with each other, which sadly happens all too often, they go to war because they believe the other nation has done something objectively wrong. May there be no sense of justice in war or injustice in war if cultural relativism is correct, because the culture defines what is right and wrong. Now, that's another reductio ad absurdum argument. Now, cultures can be wrong in how they identify reasons for war. They can be wrong in waging war, certainly. But the very concept of a cross-cultural moral judgment is eliminated by normative relativism, which is simply counterintuitive. Go to something like World War II. Pick sides. Who is right? Whatever side you pick, you think one side was right and the other side was wrong, in broad terms. So, really, relativism has very little going for it, epistemically or morally. Now, some things are relative. There's no question. People's taste in ice cream. People's taste in clothing. A lot of things, weather patterns, climates, and so on. You know, it's different here than it is in Florida. Those kind of things are relative. But when you describe the truth claim clearly and carefully enough, you still have objective truth claims. It's true that I don't like licorice. So I don't like licorice anything, you know, licorice ice cream or anything else. Licorice tea, well, it's pretty good for your throat. It's not so bad. Could probably stand some right now, but I don't really like it too much. Now, that is true, and it's either true or false, and it's true about my subjective state. But some people love licorice. So that's relative, who likes licorice and who doesn't. But if you're careful enough, you can still particularize the claim in terms of what's subjectively the case, either true or false. So people might say, oh, come on, there's so many things that are relative, and they rattle off all these things. Then you have to re-describe what they rattled off and show that they're, too, making some kind of objective claim. But the claims we're making don't have to do with taste in ice cream. They have to do with the nature of God and the universe and the human condition. And we claim those things are not relative. Questions or comments on this? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd have no principle. I mean, what's the principle that grounds the self as the determiner of truth besides sheer will? I mean, you're not a soul made in the image and likeness of God. You have no telos. You have no nature. You just appeared on the human scene for no reason, for no design. But now you are the ultimate arbiter of value. How did you get that? I think the old German philosopher Max Stirner got it exactly right. No one's ever heard of old Max. He's probably the most consistent nihilist I've ever read. Wrote a book called The Ego and Its Own. And he said that the self is ultimately empty. It's like a vacuum, but it's a consuming vacuum. It wants to incorporate everything into itself, but it has no foundation for itself. He got it exactly right. Now, why did he write his book? Is he trying to convince other people this was the case? If so, on what basis? For what reason? Could it serve him? It might serve him. It might not, and so on. We might come back to Max Stirner. But really, what justifies this legislative capacity that the relativist has? Nothing. Nothing. You might want to point that out to people. Other comments or questions? Yes. Yeah, there are problem cases, but problem cases do not invalidate principles that we know to be true in other settings. I mean, take the principle you should never torture the innocent for pleasure. Can't find a counterexample of that. Should never torture the innocent simply for pleasure. Now, the issue with the universalization is that you have to define it very carefully. Now, okay, God sends his people to destroy the Canaanites. Well, then it's not murder. It's justified killing if God sends them to do that for God's own reason. God has the power of life and death. We don't. So God can use human agents to exterminate people if it is morally justified that they be exterminated. It's not murder. Now, people might debate that, but we're not saying that murder is wrong and murder is not wrong. You have to define what murder is. And that's a question with abortion. That's a question with euthanasia and so on. So you've got to think hard and carefully about moral dilemmas. And in fact, you may not even be able to solve a moral dilemma. But I still have great confidence in basic moral principles, even if some moral dilemmas baffle me. Why let a very rare, seldom occurring thing undermine the foundations of morality? like lifeboat examples. How many times have you been on a lifeboat and there's only room for five people, but there's only four people? You know, there's a priest, there's a philosophy professor, there's a social worker, you know, and you have to decide who to kick off. How many times has that happened to you? This is how ethics was taught in the public schools for about 30 years. Moral dilemmas. It's the dumbest way to teach ethics ever devised by a human being. Unbelievable. And it gives no justification for relativism at all, because the clear cases outnumber the difficult ones 100 to 1. All right. Well, we need to talk specifically about the Christian worldview, and I want to focus in on Jesus here a little bit. I got a heartening email. I got several heartening emails this week, and believe me, I needed them, from students. They were unsolicited. One was telling me that the person really likes apologetics and engages his non-Christian friends, but had really never been doing it in terms of worldview, had been just kind of giving evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, or giving evidence for reliability of the Bible, but not really engaging the other person's system of thought, or not putting the evidence into a worldview category. You really need to do that to be effective apologetically. And sadly, some Christians don't think in these terms, but the way Sire puts it, to summarize him a little bit here, so worldview is a set of assumptions or presuppositions about the basic makeup of the world. Now, your worldview really defines how you think and how you act to a large degree. You can be inconsistent with your worldview to some degree, but what you take to be true will affect your actions, will affect your thinking, will affect your behavior. So I want to go through some of these basic propositions about what a worldview is, or a philosophy of life, or a conceptual orientation. God is infinite and personal. We're dealing with ultimate reality here, that category. So the first question is, what is your view of ultimate reality? And different worldviews will answer this differently. But the categories are neutral. I think the categories are just basic descriptive categories. They don't bias the issue to one worldview or another worldview. So, in the biblical understanding, the ultimate reality is God. God is eternal. God is all-powerful. The way Sire puts it is, God is infinite and personal, meaning triune or tri-personal, without being three gods. Transcendent and immanent, omniscient, sovereign, and good. Now, we had several chapters on Jesus, about Jesus' worldview. And sometimes we don't think about Jesus with respect to his rational arguments and his worldview. But how do we know this is Jesus' worldview? Jesus' view of God. Can you give me a text, an account, a parable, anything? That Jesus believed in this God, and for instance, was not a pantheist, or a polytheist, or an agnostic. Okay, the Jewish view of one God, certainly. Now, where can you find that? Well, Deuteronomy 6:4, that's Moses, though. Where do you find it in Jesus? Well, I and the Father are one. You have the idea of the unity of Jesus with the Father, and the Father is a personal reference, so it's both about the Father and about himself, certainly. As personal, I am. Oh, I and the Father are one. That's not John 8. John 8:58 is I am. Before Abraham was, I am. Yeah, he's calling himself God in that passage. I and the Father are one means the personality of God. How about when you pray? Sorry. Okay, which is? Yeah, they may know thee, the only true God. Great. There's one true God. And from the other teachings, you see Jesus means a personal, moral Lord of the universe. Now, the Trinity is implicit in some of the teachings of Jesus and implicit in the rest of the New Testament. It may not be explicit, but it's certainly there, especially in John 14, 15, 16, in the Great Commission, in the baptism, and other passages. Now, the reason I want to get into Jesus here is that we don't think about him enough as a philosopher, as someone having a carefully thought-out worldview. Second proposition, and putting your worldview in propositional form is not some kind of arid, abstract, modernist, white, male, rationalist, dumb, uncool, non-postmodern thing to do. Well, it is non-postmodern. That means it's cool, not uncool. It is a way to organize your thoughts. It's a way to organize your thinking. You might say, look, my friends don't want to hear these propositions. So what? You need to know them. And probably, in your witnessing to people, you're not going to read this proposition to them. But you can put it in various ways. You might even be able to put the proposition in a parable, or in a poem, or in a symbol, or refer them to a piece of literature that emphasizes one of these points. There are a lot of ways to indicate the truth, but we have to have a conceptual framework for our thoughts. That's why we do this. God created the cosmos ex nihilo, out of nothing, with a uniformity of cause and effect in an open system. Now, what does that mean? It means that the universe is orderly. It's created by an orderly, rational God. He brought it into existence out of nothing. But it's an open system, meaning that God can intervene. He can reveal himself in actions and in statements and in his Son. And he can work miracles. And human beings contribute to the destiny of the universe. We're not in the category of a machine. We are responsible moral agents under the sovereignty of God. Now, can you think of anything in Jesus' statements or his actions that indicate he believed this? Put very philosophically, but is there anything that he said, anything he did that indicates he believed this? Yes. Okay. Right. You have the sense that the supernatural power is coming from God, but that the faith opens the door to that power, at least when the people can muster it. You know, Lazarus was dead. He didn't have any faith. But sure, it's assuming that God intervenes to heal people through the ministry of Jesus. He intervenes to cast demons out of people through the ministry of Jesus. What about creation? Things in Jesus' teaching, he shows he believed in creation. Yeah.
John 17:24. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am, and to see my glory as glory you have given me, because you have given me before the creation of the world.
All right. There's a lot there. A lot of Trinitarian language and creation and soteriology and ethics. Oh, man, that's a powerful passage. You could dilate on that for hours and hours and hours. You're afraid I will. But the point is, before the creation, Jesus was with the Father. We know that also from John 1:1-3. Beginning was the Word, Word was God with God. Before the creation. So the creation occurred through the auspices of God. Okay? Anything else? From Jesus. Limited to Jesus now. Yeah. Sure. Where? You don't know? Well, you knew that much anyway. Where does... you raise your hand, anything can happen. Where does Jesus affirm the historicity of the first parents? Did you have your hand up? Go ahead.
You're asking for the first parents?
Yeah. And you memorized that, right? Okay. It's also in Matthew 19:1-2. So you can do this on all of these. And it's helpful to do it. Human beings are created in the image and likeness of God and thus possess personality, self-transcendence, intelligence, morality, gregariousness, and creativity. Well, we can go to that Matthew 19 passage. In the beginning, he created human beings. And you go back to Genesis and... also, James speaks of being made in the image and likeness of God. And there's a very powerful argument that Pascal gives called the anthropological argument for Christianity. It hasn't been used that much in apologetics, but I think it's very powerful that Christianity explains both our greatness and our misery. Greatness in terms of being made in God's image, misery because of our fallenness. And no other worldview can capture both the greatness and the misery of humanity. Fourth, Human beings can know both the world around them and God himself because God has built into them the capacity to do so because he takes an active role in communicating with them. We've talked a lot about this. The nature of God, the nature of truth, revelation, and so on. Can you think of this in Jesus' worldview, that humans can know? They can know things about God. Yes?
John 17:25. Righteous Father, though the world does not know you, I know you, and they know that you have sent me. I have made you known to them.
Yeah, I have made you known to them. So the world does not know you means the unbelievers. And John uses that word world, cosmos, in a very elastic sense to mean a lot of things. But the world does not know you, the unbelieving world. But I have made you known. I think there's a passage in John 1 where the Greek word for exegesis is there. That the Son exegeted the Father, you know, interpreted, brought out the reality of the Father in the flesh. So God is knowable through Jesus. Okay, that's one passage. Anything else you can think of? Yes. Right, same kind of construct, same kind of argument there. If you know me, you know the Father. The Father sent me, and so on. Anything else? Yeah, now where is that found? Yeah, John 14, 15, 16 in there. The Spirit will lead you. I think it's 16. The Spirit of Truth, which I think is John 16, 13 in there. Okay, 6. For each person, death is either the gate to life with God and his people or the gate to eternal separation from the only thing that will ultimately fulfill human aspirations. Point 6. So, whoops, you're right. Created good, now fallen, can be redeemed through Christ. Yeah, there are two on anthropology there. We know all those texts, I hope, about the unique message and meaning of Jesus. But the thing is, you know, if you just quote John 3:16 to somebody, or John 14:6 or something like that, and they don't have a biblical worldview, we talked about that last time, how few people have a biblical worldview, then it really doesn't mean much to them. It's just kind of a warm, happy thought. Oh, God loves me, and God did something in Jesus to show me how much he loves me, and it must be unconditional love, so God must love me just the way I am, and I don't have to change. That's really cool. Now, if you don't articulate a biblical worldview about creation, fall, redemption, consummation, you can use those four categories, people will not understand the salvation message. That's why the little booklets that we have, whether it's the four spiritual laws or whether it's the bridge illustration, unless you flesh that out with some deeper worldview considerations, people either won't get it or they'll think it's all pretty superficial. So we need to engage people about the great truths of redemption and try to figure out what they know and what they don't know, what their background is. And the whole idea of sinfulness, the whole idea of falling short of God's glory needs to be articulated. People are relativists. They have no sense of sin. It's that simple. If you're a relativist, you have no concept of sin. Now, do you have an intimation, an intuition of guilt? Yes. But can you conceptualize it properly as breaking the moral law in thought, word, and deed before a holy God? No. You try to suppress that. So we have to try to articulate why Christ came at all and what he did. The next one deals with eschatology, heaven or hell. That's not a non-negotiable part of the biblical worldview or any worldview. 7, ethics is transcendent and based on the character of God as good, meaning holy and loving. And that's implicit in so much of what Jesus says. He appeals to the authority of the Hebrew Scriptures. He appeals to God's commands as defining what is good and what is not. And we'll come back to that when we talk about the moral argument for God. The 8th point is that history is linear. It's a meaningful sequence of events leading to the fulfillment of God's purposes in history. The sense of providence. Think of anything in the teachings of Jesus related to that. History, providence, fulfillment.
Any of his plans were prophetic fulfillment.
Right. Prophetic fulfillment claims. Can you think of any specifically? Okay. Yeah, what is going to come? The end of the age, warnings about the end of the age. About Matthew 25, 31 through 46, the sheep and the goats, the ultimate separation, heaven and hell. Yes. Right. Yeah, he is fulfilling the requirements of being the Messiah. He's giving actually an argument for his messianic identity, talking about fulfillment. History was moving in his direction. He is the fulfillment of these themes and these predictions. And he's really the centerpiece of history. And history will be culminated when he comes again. Okay. All right. We could go on and on about that. But what I wanted to do is maybe to think about Jesus in some terms that we don't always think about him in. We may not think of Jesus' teachings with respect to his worldview. And again, as was mentioned earlier, Jesus taught in all kinds of ways. Questions. Jesus asked the most profound questions of people. Oftentimes they didn't expect it. Parables. Didactic statements. Arguments, you know, reductio ad absurdum. Splitting the horns of a dilemma. Just proclaiming things after he performed a miracle. He had all sorts of ways of communicating who he was and what he was doing. But it all fits within a worldview framework. He's not simply articulating ideas. He's perfectly living them out. But you can't live out an idea if you don't have one.